begun to see what you've done. What can I do but pack up and run? Now I know the rules. Get yourself another fool. You said that you love me. I was yours to command, but your kind of love my heart couldn't stand. You used me for a tool. Get yourself another fool.
From Clarksdale, Mississippi, where he was born, that's Sam Cooke with Get Yourself Another Fool. It's going to be very symbolic in our discussion today. That's from his 1963 album, Night Beat. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, June the 30th, and the U.S. Supreme Court today ruled that business owners can object on religious grounds to a provision of President Barack Obama's health care law that requires closely held private companies to provide health insurance that covers birth control. In a 5-4 vote along ideological lines, the justices said that such companies can seek an exemption from the so-called birth control mandate of the law known as Obamacare. The decision, which applies only to companies owned by a small number of individuals, means employees of those companies will have to obtain certain forms of birth control from other sources. Also in a 5-4 vote, also along ideological lines, the U.S. Supreme Court dealt a blow to public sector unions, ruling that thousands of home health care workers in Illinois cannot be required to pay fees that help cover the union's costs of collective bargaining. The justices said the practice violates the First Amendment rights of non-members who may disagree with the positions that the unions take. Well, Sam Cooke's song, The Lament of a Man Who Realizes His Love and Devotion Mean Nothing to a Heartless Lover, ought to be a political anthem for black voters in Mississippi and for the rest of us. Last Tuesday, there was a Republican runoff election for the U.S. Senate seat in Mississippi. Since none of the three candidates in the Republican primary, which was held on June the 3rd, none of them got 50% of the vote, hence the runoff. In the June 3rd primary, Chris McDaniel, bolstered by the Tea Party and a slew of right-wing endorsements, pulled 49.5% of the vote, with the incumbent U.S. Senator Thad Cochran, in office since 1978, pulling 49%. And the third candidate, Thomas Carey, with just 1.5%. But in the June 24th runoff, McDaniel was favored to win against his rival, whose seat had been cited by the National Journal as one of the five most vulnerable Senate seats in this election cycle, four of those vulnerable seats being Republican. But Cochran, a wily old politician, pulled the proverbial rabbit out of his hat. He went hunting for new votes and found 38,000 of them. And black Democrats made the difference. They helped Cochran clinch the win with a 7,000 vote margin. Cochran's Democrat assisted win set off a sonic boom across the political spectrum. Republicans see it as political sabotage and subversion and outright treachery. And Democrats and liberals are talking about a new opportunity to forge the political divide in Congress. Well, we'll hear some of those reactions now. We'll hear Rush Limbaugh going berserk, castigating the blacks who supported Cochran as Uncle Toms. We'll hear a thoroughly disgusted Glenn Beck, who had supported McDaniel, tear into Cochran and the Republican establishment with unusual scorn, even for him. And we'll hear from the CNN pulpit. We'll hear from John King, host of Inside Politics, and we'll hear from his guests, heralding the possible dawning of a bright new day.
What the campaign slogan was in Mississippi the past couple days, Uncle Tom's for Thad? Because I thought it was the worst thing you could do as an African-American and vote for a Republican. The absolute worst thing you could do, but somehow they were made to, they were made to believe that voting for old Thad would be fine and dandy. And why? Well, because they were told that Thad's done a lot for black people in Mississippi. It must be the first time they've been told that. It was 9 percentage points. Insider Republicans in the Senate bought 9 percentage points, 8 or 9 percentage points from the black Uncle Tom voters in Mississippi. Well, what they call Clarence Thomas, Condoleezza Rice, they call them Uncle Toms, the Republicans, these guys that voted for Thad, Uncle Toms for Thad. Now,
stop the music because I'm just sick to my stomach, and I think I'm a little queasy, and I think the music might throw my equilibrium off a little bit because I thought I was living in a country where we, you know, where liberty had a chance, where fair play had a chance, where we weren't talking about a GOP, a grand old party, emphasis on old, outdated, dusty, irrelevant, and never ever going to see a dime from people like me ever again. I really thought that we had a chance of some common sense, but no. Thad Cochran, a 196-year-old fart, won in Mississippi. And how did he do it? Well, he and the GOP took their money and they courted black Democrats. Now, I have a question for every black Democrat in Mississippi. What the hell has this 90-year-old fart, a white Republican, the same white Republican that for years the Democrats have been telling you are nothing but old racists? You tell me exactly what Thad Cochran did for you. What the GOP did is they reached out to the black Democrats and got the black Democrats to vote, to come in and vote. So they're much more comfortable with having Democrats come out and vote than having their base come out and vote.
Cochran, I mean, did nothing wrong here, but yep, them's the rules. And they totally, to use a cliche, disrupted how Mississippi politics right. is run in this runoff. You have to give a ton of credit to the Cochran team yep. for what they did in this runoff. It was
and the outside
striking.
Interest to the Chamber of Commerce, groups, other people came in yes, with a lot of money, expanded the field.
Uh-huh, and a lot of people are talking about that Brett Favre ad that the Chamber right. of Commerce ran. Right. Look, I think all of us were surprised. If you talk to Cochran people in the week running up to this, they thought they were still in the game. I got a call last night with about 20% in from a source of the Chamber who said, we're going to win this thing. But you're right about African-American voters. Look, I think turnout crept up across the board. The Cochran people say that. But look at Hinds County, right to the west of Jackson. You know, that's a 60% African American county, and that increased his vote margin there by 7,000 votes, and that's a great indicator of what happened.
And so the question is, he needed these votes to win. The question is, now he's the Republican nominee, he's the overwhelming favorite to keep this Senate seat in Republican hands. What does he do? Does he say thank you and forget, or might this be a turning point? Might you have an elder statesman Republican senator come back to Washington? Mississippi has the highest percentage of African American voters in the country. Look around in Alabama and South Carolina, elsewhere in the Southeast, Republican states where African Americans are often left out. Would Thad Cochran come back and tell his Republican leadership, let's have an open conversation about, say, voting rights?
Yeah, you know, possibly so. I mean, because, and that's kind of how he ran this campaign, and certainly the way he sounded during his victory speech. This is about all Mississippians. When he was running ads in African American newspapers, he talked about money that had gone to historically black colleges and universities. So perhaps he could do that. He could have a partner in somebody like Rand Paul, who's talked about restoring voting rights to felons. So possibly, but it doesn't seem like that's where the Republican Party is right now.
Cochran's never been a spotlight seeker, but I think it actually would be pretty cool.
There's an opportunity here. Yeah. Opportunity here, whether to just not have this, I needed your votes, thank you very much, and forget about it, but to come back to Washington and, God forbid, an actual competition, an actual conversation for all voters across the country would be a good thing. Keep the Mississippi...
Well, quite a sampling, wouldn't you say? And yet, all of them missing the point. And hold on to your hair, because I am going to put this in perspective, and it may surprise you, that I am going to point the finger of blame at one Jesse Jackson. I'll come back to that, but I want to let you know up front where I'm going. And it's going to sound a little odd that in the middle of all of this and all of the hubbub, I see clearly here an utter and complete failure of leadership by Jesse Jackson. And he is to blame. He's still to be held accountable for the absolute abandonment of a wonderful, wonderful opportunity paid for in blood in Mississippi. Mississippi. The wonderful state of Mississippi that is proud of its exceptionalism and its history of exceptionalism. And by that I mean exceptionalism with regard to the view that not everybody is entitled to such things as freedom and equality and justice. The history of the state of Mississippi is all about battles waged over these very concepts, these very ideals. And the struggle goes way, way, way back. This slave state is especially truculent in that it has resisted and continues to resist any substantive move away from that history. And so in this recently concluded runoff, where we hear, of course, we've just heard the reactions, but we hear hearing just the same about a tactic. This move by Cochran, the incumbent senator, the six-term incumbent senator, being very, very smart, strategically made a strategic move. He is about to lose his seat, and there's a way to save him. Save it. And the way you save it is you get the blacks. And you get the blacks to go out and get other blacks. And you get them all to give you the vote. And then it works. And then you congratulated not for consistently ignoring them all these years, but for having the political acumen, the wisdom, the savvy to know where to go to solve your problem. And it's with the black vote. But it has always been about the black vote in Mississippi. It has always been about blacks enjoying certain so-called constitutional rights of equality and freedom and justice. And we know that Mississippi has been affiliated, it has become synonymous with some of the ugliest chapters in that national story of Emmett Till, of the assassination of Medgar Evers, of the brutal attack against Fannie Lou Hamer, who eventually died of the wounds and the beating that she sustained, of the freedom riders who came in to Mississippi and the South, the Deep South, to help erase this atrocious history of segregation, of the Freedom Summers to help people learn how to read and to educate an electorate, to make them aware of the potential and actual political power they possessed. The Mississippi we know is a Mississippi that has been very fervent in its use of dogs and terrorism and police brutality and the power of the state and even the power of the federal government to quash equality and justice and freedom. We know of Fannie Lou Hamer's efforts to organize the Freedom, Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party that refused to back down. And we had Lyndon Johnson refusing to seat it at the Democratic National Convention, refusing to have her tell her story about the travails of black folk in Mississippi, just simply trying to exercise their so-called franchise, how she was evicted from her home. The land that she was farming as a sharecropper for 17 years, put out on the street because the landowner decided that she was an adjutant and that she was being encouraged by, you know the phrase, outside agitators. That's the Mississippi we know, a Mississippi that is steeped in the blood of people fighting for freedom, justice, and equality, symbolized most vividly in a shared gravesite in Neshoba County, where the bodies, the brutally beaten and disfigured bodies of Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, and James Chaney were found together. Young, hopeful spirits working for a new day in Mississippi, dying together for the cause. That's the Mississippi we know. This move by Thad Cochran is not supposed to be interpreted, I hope people don't mistake that, as some kind of awareness on his part or some degree of identification on his part with these essential struggles. I hope there's no such mistake. But still, he understood intuitively that salvation for him, his political salvation, was tied to black votes, black Democratic votes at that. Mississippi is one of about 21 states in the United States that don't have these requirements that you must have a declared party in order to participate in a primary. So that technically, its primaries are open. And so the tactic was to enlist black votes and black voters in order to save his butt. But here is where my problem is. It's not about this thing. Because in 1984, a young man presented himself to be considered for President of the United States. His name was Jesse Jackson. And in 1984, Jesse Jackson mobilized, just like Barack Obama did in 2008, mobilized a wide range, a broad swath of constituencies, as well as political bases. We discussed that. I discussed the differences between the two about a week or so ago. And this occurred on the strength of the work done by Fannie Lou Hamer and Medgar Evers and untold thousands of people in Mississippi to bring Mississippi into the real world. He capitalized on that. And he breathed a kind of new air, fresh air, invigorating the imaginations of people. People long left on the periphery of politics and of society and of the economy. He energized these groups. And there was born the concept of the Rainbow Coalition. Why? Because it was African Americans and Latinos and Arab Americans and Asians and Native Americans and farmers and poor people and working class and some middle class folks and gays and lesbians and whites and progressives. They all saw a reason to become energetic about supporting Jesse Jackson. And in fact, Jesse Jackson was in a pretty crowded race with some heavyweights as a political neophyte. But so strong was the conviction of his constituencies and his political base, you know what they did for Jesse Jackson in Mississippi? They delivered. They delivered for Jesse Jackson in Mississippi. That's astounding. Jesse Jackson that year, in 1984, garnered 3.2 million votes in a primary. 18%, 18.2, in fact, percent of the total. That's impressive. He won five primaries and caucuses, including in the slave states of Louisiana, Virginia, South Carolina, and even in the District of Columbia. But in Mississippi, he won pretty big. That's huge, because Mississippi has the largest number of black eligible voters in the country. So Mississippi is a great marker, and he did phenomenally well as a first-time candidate. He didn't win the nomination, but it wasn't important to win in that sense, because people by then had redefined winning. Winning was gathering momentum. Winning was carrying on with the leg, this first leg, this new leg of the race. And Jesse Jackson was the strong man on the field. He was on the track. And even if he did not capture the presidential nomination, he would have garnered enough momentum and enough clout within the political world to flex muscles in behalf of the disfranchised. And so they made the investment. And it worked. Four years later, Jesse Jackson did something equally stupendous. This time, he won Mississippi outright. In an eight-way race, he captured Mississippi. Nobody expected it. And he more than doubled his votes. This time, Jesse Jackson had truly demonstrated momentum. He got 6.9 million votes and won seven primaries in Alabama, the District of Columbia, Georgia, Louisiana, Puerto Rico, Virginia, and Mississippi. So, this was a viable enterprise, powered by people, regular people, hurdling over all the historical barriers to working together, forming coalitions, backing up a candidate who had said that he identified with all these disparate causes because they were just and right and were in line with the vision of a Fannie Lou Hamer and a Medgar Evers and a Martin Luther King and all of the stalwarts that came before them. Except, Mr. Jackson decided to commodify his political run, to make it pay. And so he put himself and every one of those 6.9 million votes up on the auction block and sold everybody back onto the political slave plantation. He sold out body and soul to the Democrats. And they didn't even have to ask him. He decided to do what so many black leaders have done, and that is to spit on the history of struggle of black people and progressive people in this country. He arrogated to himself this so-called Rainbow Coalition as if it were his private property, and folks have yet to challenge him on it. I've talked about this for years. Nobody has publicly canceled his contract. It doesn't belong to him. It's not his personal property. And we see at every turn where his presence should and could make a huge difference in political, social, and economic outcomes for distressed people in this country, he has no currency left. And it is all his doing. It is his personal betrayal. It is his personal choice. Now, he had two shots at it. Does that remind you of somebody we know? two shots at it. And the evidence is clear that the people did exactly what was asked of them. Just like they did last week on the 24th, when the black leaders stood up and said, you know what? Yeah, Thad Cochran is Republican, but he's a Republican we can trust. So even if you're a Democrat, if you're black, go ahead and vote for him, because we can work with him. And guess what? The people did exactly that, trusting corrupted black leadership who don't have a working soul in their bodies anymore, who have no fidelity to struggle or to the obligation to see through the struggles begun by those extraordinary men and women and young people in the name of all that is good. What would have happened? What would the situation have been? It is 30 years since Jackson's betrayal. And in these 30 years, we have had a white senator, part of the political establishment, the Republican establishment. Mississippi is catching hell. Blacks in Mississippi catching more hell than everybody else. What could the political alternative have been had Jesse Jackson had the moral fiber to stay the course and to honor the struggle that went on before him and to honor the investment made in him in 1984 and 1988? Here we have the head of the Congressional Black Caucus making the most stupid announcement that in the event of Thad Owens prevailing in the general election, you know, well, now we need to call on him and we need to make demands of him. You can't make demands of anybody. You don't qualify to make demands. You sold out. You can't even make requests. You have no political currency. And it's not because people didn't make the investment. It's not because people ignored their political futures. It's not because people didn't go out to vote. It's not because people were apathetic. It's not because people didn't care about politics and that they had other things on their mind. They did exactly what their leadership requested them to do. And look what we got. And look how much time has frittered away. And look how much ground has been lost. And look how much devastation has basically accumulated to generations over the last 30 odd years alone. When there was not just opportunity, but the people made it real, made it possible. The people did their jobs. The people complied. The people invested. The people got exercised about their interests and their future. And their leadership, their black leadership, was no less heartless than the senator who just calculated, look, I just need your votes to win. Give me your votes. Thanks a lot. See you next time. No difference whatsoever. And so, we get the discussion revolving around tactics and not history. The smart strategy of a politician versus the decades of neglect and betrayal. And this is why it infuriates me when people start talking about black folks being apathetic and they're not, the numbers and the figures just don't suggest that at all. What has not happened is that there has got to be a connection between the conditions today and the acts of treason committed by so-called black leadership yesterday and the day before. For the sake of having stature and for thinking that you matter, for the sake of stroking your ego and giving you a sense that you're important, for the sake of making it possible for individuals to make a very good living, commodifying history, commodifying struggle, making money off of death and lynchings and killings and kidnappings and disappearances and brutal beatings and denials of rights, you willing to engage in the same kind of activity as the people who historically have had an oppressive foot on our necks? And that is why what we should be understanding about that election in Mississippi is the utter, complete and total failure of Jesse Jackson, and why we must remember that we are prone to leaders such as this, and therefore the old paradigms ought to be put aside. They should no longer work because they have yielded exactly the same result over and over and over again. Now you see how I connect the dots. I'll pause now and take your calls when we come back from this little break at 888-874-4888.
And now that we're through, you say you're meant to be true. Oh, but deep down in your heart, I know that our love could never grow. I tried to believe you, that we'd never part, that your kind of love broke my poor heart. Now I know the rules. Get yourself another fool.
You know, I'm going to first remake that the anthem for all political activists, especially for folks in the black community looking for black leadership. 888-874-4888. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and your calls are featured right now. Sarah, you're on the air.
Yes, Utrice. Greetings to you and the PRN listening.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you, ma'am. Utrecht, that is correct. You need to play that as a lead-in and a lead-out whenever you do these shows dealing with black politics. Because I don't know what's going on. Are you in an echo?
No.
Okay. It's gone now. Okay, I guess the NSA was on this call because I was hearing an echo myself. They didn't tie up their loose ends because I was hearing myself echoing back, so they must have straightened it out. But anyway, the situation that I was following that whole Utrecht with that election in Mississippi, and I agree with you 100%. The thing with Jesse Jackson and with the Rainbow Push, I'm going to kind of hold on that for a little bit before I come down real heavy with a ton of bricks. But my thing with the people in Mississippi, Utrecht, is, and this election, it shows once again the sophisticatedness of black people and our voting and how we like to go out here and vote without knowing what the heck it is that we are voting for. We have no clear goals. We have no idea of what we are doing. We always like to pull out that stupid phrase, the better of two evils, when you are still ending up with evil. Now, these people are not going to get nothing for it, as you said, with March of Fudge and our foolishness about, you know, putting pressure. How can you put pressure on somebody after the fact? Pressure is done before you go out and you give these people your votes. You're going to get something in written form. This is what we expect of you, and this is what we're going to get from you if we are to give you this vote.
Absolutely.
What do they do then?
Well, that's my point exactly. And, you know, the sad part of it is that people are, to the extent that they're exercising this franchise, they're looking to leadership to help them make some sense of where to make the investment. That's the point I'm making. And they're getting really bad advice out here. Thanks
not only
for calling.
Not only that, with the leadership, Utrecht is like what Alton was stating with voter education, where people don't know what they're doing. All they think is that you have a ballot and you're supposed to go and vote because somebody died to give you that right to vote. But if you are voting and you are putting yourself in an oppressive position, you're not effectively using your ballot. And that's what we have been doing, Utrecht, ever since we've been voting. We have not yet empowered ourselves with this ballot. We're the only group who have never empowered ourselves through voting. And I think it is time we need to stop and go a different route.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
DX from LA, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrecht. How are
Hello.
You on this wonderful
Fine,
day?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I was listening to you, and man, I mean, I feel exactly what you're saying. And this is one of the points I make all the time. I only had like a couple of comments to make this morning. We'll have to talk more about this maybe on Friday or something like that. But there's a certain synergy going on this morning because as you were speaking and as we were playing those clips, I was reading an article entitled Black America Loses Its Gamble in Electing the First Black President. It's on a website called the Black Star Project, and it's basically we sold out. Well, the assertion of the article is that black community has sold out its children's, mostly black male children's, future just to have a black president. And if you get into the article, it states some of the things that you just asserted. And I want to know why. You know, this is my point that I make all the time. These black leaders have been shown time and time again to be either corrupt or not know what they're talking about. But why do black people keep on listening?
We're breaking up a little bit here, DX.
Excuse
but
me?
the why is easily understood. I mean, if we understand the power, the awesome power of media and political organization, organized to a frighteningly accurate level with the Obama campaigns of 2008 and 2012, where people are basically tackled on a psychological level. You can't underestimate the psychological damage that has been done by just the conditions of life in the United States. It reduces people to all kinds of inexplicable levels. You would think, well, these are logical people. They know right from wrong and all this other kind of stuff. But that doesn't matter when you are euphoric about something, when you have been energized and you've been the target of sophisticated campaigns to distract you from really thinking logically.
Yes, I understand this, Utrice. But Utrice, one sentence that you said summed up some of my points here, and that sentence was that Mississippi has the largest block of black voters of any state in the nation. They also have the highest unemployment of blacks, the poorest blacks in the country. It's the poorest. It's the worst state for a black to be in.
DX, I'm so sorry. The phone is hard to hear you. It's very, very fractured.
Okay, let me try something here.
Okay.
Is that better?
Much better. As my nephew would say, more gooder.
Okay. So I was saying that one sentence that you said sort of encapsulates it for me, and that is that Mississippi has the largest block of black voters.
We're back again. We're having serious trouble.
Can't hear me again?
Yeah, it's very hard to hear you.
Okay, well, maybe we'll just take this up on Friday. I'll let someone else go ahead and give a call.
Thank you so much. But we got the gist of your call just the same, and thank you for that. Green from Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice. I hope you're well.
How are you?
I refuse to complain. Utrice, this election in Mississippi was a primary, I do believe.
Oh, we're having phone trouble with you too, Green. What's going on?
I don't know.
Are you talking on a speakerphone or something?
No, I'm... I'm sorry. Yes, I am. Okay, can you hear me better?
Could you try a more direct approach?
No,
maybe it would help? Oh, no, it's really bad. Are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, let's try it. Let's go ahead.
Okay. This election in Mississippi was a primary. And it's not that people switched to
Republican. Oh, no, it's really bad. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's very bad.
Okay. Look, have a good day.
Well, let's try Chicago. Henry, let's see what's going on. You better have a good working phone there, Henry.
I'm going to try. But you know what, Utrice? I'm hearing the callers very well. I didn't hear any breakup, so I don't know. It might be something on your end. But can you hear me?
Yes, I'm hearing you.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, to my point, I think I talked about this before on your show in regards to political ignorance that we have. And I think it starts very much on the early age because we're not very politically educated and we don't really get that political education, you know, probably up until we get into college. So this is why we have, you know, one or two leaders controlling the vote, you know, a block of votes in the black community. And I've always stressed that we need to politically educate our children very early. I remember taking a political science course in college, and one simple assignment that the professor asked us to do was to fill out a political organization chart by where you live at. So basically, it went down all the way to the alderman, all the way up to the president, and nobody outside of the president they could name, you know, as far as like, you know, who their alderman is, who their congressman is. And it was a very difficult assignment for them. So, you know, it shows how politically ignorant we are and how we don't get, you know, this type of education, because I feel like if we get it early, we can synthesize and analyze it, you know, when we get older, and we could basically make more choices, better choices in our political direction. So that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you for that. But I think, you know, in a way, it kind of moves the burden of responsibility for immediate choice and action. And this is really what the whole point of it is. The people who are presented the task of making best use of the investment are just not worthy. And that is the issue. I don't know. I agree with you that we need civics. We need people to know how government works and, you know, the form of government that we have in the United States and so forth. All these things are very good, and that's very helpful. But the task here is, how does the electorate deal with treacherous leadership? The leadership that squanders the investment made in it, the leadership that betrays the trust, the leadership that refuses to take on the task of building on the gains of the struggles that came before. That is the challenge to us today. Thank you so much, Henry, for your call. Well, we've come to the end of our program, and I hope that this encourages us to revisit this question, because it is a permanent flaw within just the electorate at large, but especially within the African American and Latino communities. We have horrible leadership that has opted more often than not to betray the interests of the people who do exactly what was asked in good faith. And with a great sense of obligation and honor to what they believe, of course they told it, but what they believe to be a sincere effort to advance the cause. And of course it turns out to be an exercise by individuals to simply set themselves up for some kind of a personal privilege, and to make money and to gain stature and whatever else it is that they set as their private agendas, but to supplant the interests of the majority in order to achieve their personal agendas. This is the running theme. And at one point, would people decide that it has got to stop, and that they are the ones in charge of stopping it and calling these folks out? Stop making it a secret that you're disenchanted, or that you expected better of them, or that they have fallen way beneath the standard and the expectation that you have. As people who have a right because of the vote to be critical, openly critical. Don't hide it. They're not hiding it. They're not hiding it at all. They're very out there with the fact that they're getting on with their business, and their business is, you know, their personal fortunes. And we've got to stop it. It's a very bad habit, and it has absolutely retarded our growth as a people, as a community, as a nation. So when you see these kinds of stories, and of course the media would lift them completely out of context, always remember there's a reason to make these things connect with the history that we know. This race that was run just last week didn't just occur in a vacuum. When you connect the dots, when you connect the history, you see how sad it is. It is actually a commentary that the people of Mississippi, and in a way the people of the nation, because this is a U.S. Senate seat, have suffered the setbacks for 30 years and more because a leader failed to do what he should have done and failed to accomplish what should have been accomplished by now, to move the struggle that further forward. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com, on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Bye-bye. Broke my